It was a man's room, shelves filled with men's books, encyclopedias and almanacs, and thick leather-bound volumes of travel and exploration. Weapons hung upon the walls, bows and quivers of poisoned bushman arrows, shields and assegais of Matabele and Zulu, and, of course, the tools of the trade to which Zuga had reverted. Firearms, heavy-caliber sporting rifles by famous gunsmiths, Gibbs, Holland and Holland, Wesley Richards. They were racked on the wall facing the fireplace, blued steel and lovingly carved wood. With them were the souvenirs and trophies of Zuga's work, horns of antelope and buffalo, twisting or curved or straight as a lance, the zigzag stripes of a zebra hide, the tawny gold bushed mane of the Kalahari lion, and ivory, great yellow arcs reaching higher than a man's head, yellow as fresh butter and translucent as candle wax in the cold winter light from the doorway. "You had a good trip?" Jordan asked, and Zuga shrugged. "It gets more difficult each season to find good specimens for my clients." His clients were rich and aristocratic sportsmen, come out to Africa for the chase. But at least the Americans seem to have discovered Africa at last. I have a good party booked for next season. Young fellow called Roosevelt, Secretary of the Navy. He broke off. "Yes, we are managing to keep body and soul together, old Yun Shirut and I, but I don't have to ask about you." He glanced down at the expensive English cloth of Jordan's suit, the soft leather of his riding boots, which creased perfectly around his ankles like the bellows of a concertina, the solid silver spurs and the gold watch chain in his fob pocket, and then his eye paused on the white sparkle of the diamond in his cravat. "You made the right choice when you decided to go with Rhodes. My God, how that man's star rises higher and brighter with each passing day. He's a great man, Papa. Or a great rogue." Then Zuga smiled apologetically. "I am sorry. I know how highly you think of him. Let's have a glass of sherry, Geordie, while Yun Shirut makes lunch for us." He smiled again. "We miss your cooking. You will find it poor fare, I'm afraid." While he poured sweet cape sherry into long glasses, he asked over his shoulder, "And Ralph? What do you hear of Ralph?" "Oh, we meet often in Kimberley or at the railhead. He always asks after you." "How is he?" "He will be a big man, Papa. Already his wagons run to Pilgrim's Rest and those new goldfields on the Witwatersrand. He has just won the fast coach contract from Algoa Bay. He has trading posts at Tati and on the Shashi River." They ate in front of the fire, sour bread and cheese, a cold joint of mutton and a black bottle of Constantia wine. And Yun Shirut hovered over Jordan, scolding him fondly for his appetite and recharging his glass when it was barely a quarter empty. At last they finished and stretched out their legs towards the fire, while Yun Shirut brought a burning taper to light the cigars which Jordan produced from a gold pocket case. Jordan spoke through the perfumed wreaths of smoke. "Papa, the concession." And for the first time, an angry arrowhead creased the skin between Zuga's eyes. "I had hoped that you came to see us," he said coldly. "I keep forgetting that you are Rhodes's man, ahead of being my son." "I am both," Jordan contradicted him evenly. "That's why I can talk to you like this." "What message has the famous Mr. Rhodes for me this time?" Zuga demanded. "Maund and Saluce have both accepted his offers. They have sold their concessions to Mr. Rhodes, and both are £10,000 richer." Maund was a soldier and an adventurer. Fred Saluce, like Zuga, a hunter and explorer. Also, like Zuga, Saluce had written a well-received book on the African chase, A Hunter's Wanderings in Africa. Both of these men had at different times prevailed on Lobengula to grant them concessions to ivory and minerals in his eastern dominions. "Mr. Rhodes wants me to point out to you that both the Maund and Saluce concessions are over the same territory as the concession that Mzilikazi granted to you. He owns both of them now. The validity of all the treaties is hopelessly confused and hazy." "The Ballantyne concession was granted first by Mzilikazi. The ones that followed have no force," snapped Zuga. Mr. Rhodes's lawyers have advised... Damn Mr. Rhodes and his lawyers! Damn them all to hell! Jordan dropped his eyes and was silent. And after a long pause, Zuger sighed and stood up. He went to the yellowwood cupboard and took out a stained and dog-eared document, so ragged that it had been pasted onto a backing to prevent it falling to pieces. The ink had faded to brown, but the script was bold and spiky, the hand of an arrogant and cocksure young man. The document was headed, "Exclusive concession to mine gold and hunt ivory in the sovereign territory of Matabeleland." And at its foot was a crude wax seal with the image of a bull elephant and the words, "Nkosi Nkulu, Great King." Below, a shaky cross in the same faded ink. "Mzilikazi, His Mark." Zuga laid the document on the table between them, and they both stared at it. "All right," Zuga capitulated. "What do Mr. Rhodes's lawyers advise?" "That this concession could be set aside on 5 separate points of law."
"I would fight him."
"Papa, he is a determined man. His influence is enormous. He will be Prime Minister of the Cape Parliament at the next session. There is little doubt of that." Jordan touched the red wax seal. "His fortune is vast. Perhaps 10 million pounds.
"Still, I will fight him," Zuga said,
and then stopped Jordan speaking with a hand on his arm. "Jordan, don't you understand? A man must have something, a dream, a light to follow in the darkness. I can never sell this. It has been all of my life for too long. Without it, I shall have nothing. Papa, I know what you will say, that I can never make this into reality. I do not have the money it would need. You might even say that I no longer even have the strength of purpose. But, Jordan, while I have this piece of paper, I can still hope. I still have my dream to follow. I can never sell it." I told him that, and he understood immediately. He wants you to be part of it. Zuga lifted his head and stared at his son. "A seat on the board of governors of the company for which Mr. Rhodes will petition a royal charter from Her Majesty. Then you will have grants of farmland, gold claims, and an active command in the field. Don't you see, Papa? He's not taking your dream away from you. He's making it come true at last." The silence drew out. A log crumbled and crashed softly in the hearth. Sparks shot up, and the flare lit Zuga's face. "When will he see me?" he asked.
"Oh, he can be at Krutaskur in 4 hours' ride."
"It'll be dark by then."
"There are 15 bedrooms for you to choose from," Jordan smiled. And Zuga laughed like a man who has been given back all the excitement and eagerness of youth.
"Then why are we sitting here?" he asked. "Jan Sharoot, bring my heavy coat." Zuga strode out onto the veranda of the cottage, and on the top step he checked and reached out with his right hand to the pillar of blue stone. He touched it with a strangely formal caress, and with the same hand touched his own lips and forehead, the gesture with which an Arab greets an old friend. Then Zuga glanced at Jordan and smiled.
"Superstition,"
he explained.
"Good luck."
"Good luck?" Jan Sharoot snorted from below the steps where he held Zuga's horse. "Damn stone, all the way from Kimberley. Trip over the thundering rubbish," he went on muttering to himself as Zuga mounted. "Jan Sharoot would pine away if he didn't have something to complain about." Zuga winked at Jordan, and they trotted out from under the milkwood trees onto the track. "I often think back to that day when we hit the blue," Jordan said.
"If we had only known."
"How could we know?" "It was I feel sure of that. It was I who convinced you that the blue ground was barren."
"Jordan, you were only a boy."
"But I was supposed to be the diviner of diamonds. If I had not been so certain that it was dead ground, you would never have sold the Devil's Own."
"I never sold it.
I gambled it away."
"Only because you thought it was worthless. You would never have accepted Mr. Rhodes's bet if you had known that the blue was not the end, but only the beginning."
"Nobody knew that then." "Not then." "Mr. Rhodes sensed it. He never lost faith. He knew what the blue was. He knew it with a certain instinct that nobody else had."
I have never been back to Kimberley, Geordie. Zuga settled down in the saddle, riding with long stirrups like a boer hunter. I never wanted to go back, but of course the news filters down the line of rail. I heard that when Rhodes and Bonato made their deal, they valued the Devil's Own claims at £500,000. They were the keys to the field, Geordie explained. It just happened that they were the central claims in the main enrichment. But you could never have guessed that, Papa. Strange how right one man's instincts can be, Zuga brooded, and how wrong another man's. I always knew, or thought I knew, that my road to the north began at that hole, that terrible hole. Well, perhaps it still does. The money to take us all to the north will still come from it. Mr. Rhodes's millions. Tell me about the blue. You've been with Rhodes through it all. Tell me about it. It changes, Jordan said. It's as simple as that. It alters. Zuga shook his head. It's like some sort of miracle. Yes, Jordan nodded. Diamonds are nature's beautiful miracles. I'll never forget my own astonishment when Mr. Rhodes showed it to me. That hard blue rock is unyielding as any granite when it comes out of the earth, and yet after it has been laid out in the stacking fields for a year or two, it starts to crumble. It's the sunlight, we think, that does it. It crumbles up like a loaf of stale bread. And the diamonds, oh, Papa, the diamonds, incredible stones, 11,000 carats of diamonds each day. The blue is the mother lode. The blue is the heart. He broke off in embarrassment. Sometimes I run away with myself, he confessed, and Zuga smiled with him. Who could resist this beautiful young man? That was the word to describe him. Not handsome, not good-looking, but beautiful, with a quality of gentleness and goodness that seemed to form an aura about him. Papa, Jordan sobered. Oh, Papa, you'll never know how happy I am that you are to be part of it after all. You and Mr. Rhodes. Mr. Rhodes, Zuga thought indulgently. Always Mr. Rhodes. And yet it's a good thing for a young man to have a hero. Pity this poor world of ours when the last hero passes. Can you judge a man by his books? Zuga wondered. The library was choked with them. One complete wall packed to the ceiling with the sources and references which Gibbon had consulted for his Decline and Fall. So impressed had Rhodes been with this work that he had ordered Hatchards of London to collect and, if necessary, translate and bind the complete authorities. Jordan said it had cost him £8,000 thus far and was not yet complete. Ranked beside this formidable array were all the published lives of Alexander, of Julius Caesar, and of Napoleon. What dreams of empire they must sustain! Zuga smiled inwardly as he listened to the high, hypnotic voice of the burly figure with the flushed, swollen face, as he sat behind the vast desk into whose panels were chiselled the stylized figures of the bird, the falcon of Zimbabwe. "You are an Englishman, Ballantyne, a man of honour and dedication. These things have always attracted me to you." He was irresistible, able to conjure up a gamut of emotions with a few words, and Zuga smiled at himself again. He was in danger of the same hero worship as his own son. "I want you even more than this concession of yours. You understand, you know what it is we seek. Not merely wealth and personal aggrandizement. No, no, no. It is something beyond that, something sacred." Then he came to it abruptly, without flourish. "There," Rhodes said. "You know what I need. You and your concession. What do you want from me in return?" "What task will I perform?" Zuga asked. "Good," Rhodes nodded the untidy leonine head. "Glory before gold. You please me, Ballantyne. But to business. I had thought to ask you to lead the occupying expedition, to guide it over the ground you know so well, but other men can do something as simple as that. I shall let Sir Luce do it. I have something more important for you. You will be my alter ego at the kraal of the Matabele King. The savages know and respect you. You speak their language, know their customs. You are a soldier. I have read your military paper on the tribe. And we must not deceive ourselves, Ballantyne. It may come to a military option. Few other men can do all these things, have all these qualities." They stared at each other across the desk, both men leaning forward. And then Rhodes spoke again.
"I am not a mean man, Ballantyne. Do the job for me and you can name your rewards. Money, £10,000. Land, each land grant will be, 4,000 acres. Gold claims, each will be 500 yards square. How many, shall we say? 5 of each? £10,000 in cash? 20,000 acres of prime land of your choice? 5 claims on the rich gold reef over which you shot the great elephant that you describe in Hunter's Odyssey? What do you say, Ballantyne?"
10 of each, said Zuger. £10,000, 10 land grants, 10 gold claims.
Done, Rhodes slapped the desk. Write it down, Jordan, write it down. But what of your salary while you are agent at Lobengula's Kraal? 2,000, 4,000 per annum? I am not a mean man, Ballantyne.
And I am not a greedy one.
4,000, then? And we are all agreed, so we can go to lunch.
Zuger stayed 5 days at Grooteskuur, days of talking and planning and listening. It amused him to see the legend dispelled, the idea of Rhodes as a solitary and brooding man, withdrawn to some high Olympus, where other men could not follow, was proved to be a myth. For Rhodes surrounded himself with men. There was not a meal at which less than 15 sat to his generous board. What men they were, too! Clever or rich or both, belted earls or farm-boy boers, politicians and financiers, judges and soldiers. And if they were not wealthy, they were powerful or useful or merely amusing. At one dinner there was even a poet, a bespectacled little shrimp of a man, on passage from Indian service back to England. Jordan had read his plain tales from the hills and secured an invitation for him, and despite his appearance, the company was quite taken with him. Rhodes invited him to return and write about Africa.
"The future is here, young Kipling, and we shall need a poet to sing for us."
Men by the dozen, and never a woman. Rhodes refused to have a woman servant in the house. There was not even a painting of a woman on the walls. And the taciturn, brooding figure of legend never stopped talking. From the back of a horse, as they rode through the estate, striding over the lawns with his clumsy, uncoordinated gait, seated behind the teak desk or at the head of the long, laden dining table, he talked. Figures and facts and estimates poured from him without reference to notes, other than an occasional glance at Jordan for confirmation. Then came the ideas, fateful, ludicrous, prophetic, fascinating or fantastic, but never-ending. To a visiting member of the British Parliament,
"We have to make a practical tie with the old country, for future generations will be born beyond its shores. It must be useful, physical and rewarding for both, or we shall drift apart."
To an American senator,
"We could hold Parliament for 5 years in Westminster and for the next 5 in Washington."
To a rival financier who enviously sniped at his monopoly of the diamond industry,
"Without me, the price of diamonds would not make it worthwhile turning over a stone to pick one up. Kimberley would revert to desert and 30,000 would starve."
When they began to plan the grand expedition to the north, Zuger had imagined that Rhodes would concern himself with each detail. He was wrong. He defined the objective.
"We need a document from Lobengula ratifying and consolidating all these grants into a single concession that I can take to London."
Then he picked the man.
"Rudd, you have the legal mind,"
and gave him carte blanche.
"Go and do it. Take Jordan with you. He speaks the language. Take anyone else you need."
Then to Zuger,
"We need an occupying force, small enough to move fast, large enough to protect itself against Matabele treachery. Ballantyne, that'll be your first concern. Let me know what you decide. But remember, there is little time."
What might have taken another man 6 months was accomplished in 5 days. And when Zuger left Grooteskuur, Jordan rode with him as far as the neck of the mountain. The wind had gone up into the northwest, and then came down like a ravenous beast, roaring dully against the crags of the mountain and bringing in cold, steely grey rain squalls off the Atlantic. It could not blunt their spirits, and although their wind-driven oilskins flogged their bodies and the horses shivered and drooped their ears, they shouted above the wind, "Isn't he a great man? Every minute spent in his company is like a draught of fine wine. intoxicating with excitement. He is so generous. Though he is the one, of course, who profits most from his generosity, Zuga laughed. Oh, that's mean, Papa. A saint does not make such a fortune in so short a time. But if anybody can do this thing, then it is Rhodes, and for that I will follow him into hell itself. Well, let's pray that won't be necessary. At the top of the pass, the wind was stronger still, and Jordan had to turn his horse until their knees touched. Papa, the column, the occupying column. There is one person who has the wagons, who knows the route, can requisition the supplies and recruit the men. Who is that, Geordie? Ralph,